UTA Radio.
UTA Radio.
Radio. UTA.
UTA Radio.
Idaat UTA.
.com.
Author of Freakonomics, an award-winning Harvard economist, an education activist, and a UTA alumnus, Roland Fryer, welcome to UTA Radio News.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So, what was your time at UTA like?
I don't think I can say that on the radio. It was great. I really had a wonderful time here. It feels like many moons ago. It was about 20 years ago at this point. But it was great. I lived close to campus and hung out and worked hard and played hard. It was a really awesome experience.
Would you say UTA prepared you for a career at Harvard? Or if it did, how so?
That's interesting. I think it definitely prepared me. It gave me the confidence to believe that I was well-educated. I was in the honors program here, and I went from here to Penn State, and from Penn State to University of Chicago, and University of Chicago to Harvard. So Penn State definitely gave me the basic economic tools and also just a love for the subject that I carried forward as I went to those other institutions.
Over that break, you were telling me that you switched between like a lot of majors. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I feel like a lot of students nowadays, we actually do that and we go through that and we feel like it's going to be the end of the world if we don't know what we want to do.
Yeah, I had no clue what I wanted to do. In fact, when I applied to graduate school, I think I applied to business schools, law schools, economics departments. I just had no idea. And I wasn't really, commitments wasn't really my thing. So yeah, I think I majored in, let's see, I tried sociology. That was too hard. And then I looked into communications, English. I really liked English, except for I kind of wanted a job after I left here. So I decided maybe that wasn't for me. In the end, I ended up majoring in economics and minoring in math, which was probably maybe my 8th or 10th major or something like that. But I just couldn't really get a feel for what I wanted to do until I took my first economics class.
And do you remember the professor you took it with?
I think his name was Professor Ryan Amacher. He taught principles of economics. I'll never forget it because it was an 8 o'clock class and he had 7 a.m. office hours, which now that I'm a professor, I realize was a trick. No one was supposed to show up, but I used to actually show up because I could just walk right across campus. And he really got me fired up about economics, and that has not changed since I left his class.
So your talk tonight is titled Solutions to Fixing Education in America, No More Excuses. What would you say is wrong with our education system in America?
How much time you got? there's a lot wrong. I think the basic, let's not focus on the inputs here. Let me talk like an economist for a second. But let's focus on the output. The output tells me something's wrong. There are huge achievement gaps between America and other countries, as well as even larger achievement gaps among different groups within our own country, right? So there's not a city in America in which more than 30% of black or brown kids can read or do math at grade level. And that's just absolutely crazy. That's just unbelievable that we live in a country so rich and so prosperous on so many other dimensions that we can't figure out a way to educate our most vulnerable citizens. So that's the kind of, that's the part of the education system I focus on. I do a lot of work in inner cities, a lot of work in schools that are fundamentally broken, and try to figure out ways to help fix them.
Is there something that we can do to, you know, go about fixing it? And by we, I mean normal citizens who are not part of the school board or not part of the school system.
Well, if you're normal citizens, you vote, right? So let's hold our politicians accountable for actually changing the results of our schools instead of giving us, you know, rhetoric that's about those schools, right? We see politicians get elected over and over again saying things like, we're going to increase spending and lower class size. Okay, great. But why don't we say, if you don't actually have better results during your tenure as a congressman or woman or a senator, then we're going to vote for somebody else. I mean, we should be demanding results, not only in our own schools, but realizing that kids in all public schools are our children. And we have to figure out a way to ensure a level playing field for everyone.
Some of us, you know, while college students, we are parents. Is there something that we could do as parents for the education of our children?
Stay engaged, you know. I can't tell you how delighted and excited I am to be at UTA, but I miss my four-year-olds parent-teacher conference this morning. So, you know, I'm always at her school. I'm trying to be engaged. We have to make sure we're understanding what's going on in our children's classrooms and in our children's education before they get to classrooms, and make sure they're prepared and hold our teachers accountable for results and for success. Look, I don't believe in education reform for other people's children, right? Everything that I recommend for inner cities in Dallas, Houston, LA, Chicago, New York are the same things I want for my own 4-year-old kid. I want them to be loved, cared for. I want them to reach their own frontier. I want their ideas to be their only constraint. And we are so far from that place in America. But come tonight, you'll realize I'm optimistic. We can get there. And I'll talk a lot about that tonight. The question is, frankly, do we have the courage to actually do what we know needs to be done?
So in July of 2016, you published an empirical analysis of racial differences in police use of force, in which you found that there was no bias against Black civilians in police shootings in 10 cities and counties, including Houston. Can you tell us a little bit more about that research?
Sure. I can't get away from that, which is good. We need to have this discussion. Look, there are two types of force that police use. One, let's call lower level uses of force. And they're not low levels. They're just lower levels. Okay. So they range from putting their hands on people to, you know, tasing them. All right. But it's not the use of deadly force. And then there's deadly force. What we find is that there are huge racial disparities on the lower level uses of force. Black and brown citizens in America are 53% more likely to have a police officer put their hands on them. They're more likely to be thrown to the ground. They're more likely to be thrown up against a car. Look, I grew up 30 minutes from here in Lewisville, Texas. I have had several guns pulled on me by the police, been thrown up against cars. I know what that's like. All right? It is not fun, okay? Folks who are out there potentially listening, who have had that happen to them, are rolling their eyes right now because that's so obvious. But for folks who don't, you got to understand, lower level uses of force matter a lot. And they happen all the time. Millions of those incidences happen every week, every month in America. Then there are the police shootings. And the police shootings are where we focused our national attention because we've all seen these 11 or 12 viral videos that have all made us sick to our stomachs as we've seen folks without being armed many times be shot by the police. In those instances, to my great amazement, it's the biggest surprise in any research I've ever engaged in the last 15 years, was that we didn't find bias in the shootings, but we found a lot of bias in everything that was not a shooting. Okay. And you know, look, there are, I don't know, in a place like Houston, there are 50 police shootings a year, but there are thousands and thousands of lower level uses of force. And look, if you ask me, the reason that folks are out in the street protesting is not because they've done a statistical calculation about the guilt or innocence of Michael Brown or Laquan McDonald or others. They're out there because they don't like and they don't trust the police. And the reason they don't like or the reason they don't trust the police is because many of us have had these lower level uses of force when we've done nothing. Okay? So that's the place to start, I believe. And, you know, some people, when they hear that message, get upset because of the police shootings. I'm upset too, but the data are what the data are. I'm not making them up, right? We have 10 cities. It very well could be, if you have many more cities, that the results will change. I don't know. I can only speak from the data I have. But what I can say is that as I've gone across the country and talked to police departments, I'm actually talking to the police chief here in Arlington in the morning before I go back home. When I've talked to police across the country, they have said to me, look, shooting your gun is a life-changing event for us too, right? It's a big deal. I haven't had many people across the country tell me that roughing up a black or a brown kid is a life-changing event. And we got to make it so. We need policy changes. We need a national use of force policy that punishes those who use excessive force, right? Like, I totally get that being a police officer is a tough job. But it's also tough to ride through your own neighborhood and be thought of as suspicious. And so I believe that that's what's going on. And it's hard as I go across the country and talk to, you know, folks, that's one of the things that makes young black and brown children feel that the world is rigged, because it's kind of hard. Like when I was in school, you'd go to school and they would say, you can be anything you want if you could just find a way to get home safely. That's just crazy. So many more instances of lower level uses of force. I think we can do something about that policy wise, and we need to collect more data on the lethal uses of force.
This study, I should say, was quite controversial, especially with the recent kneeling in the NFL debate. I saw it used as to justify that the fact that kneeling is not being, if you kneel during the national anthem, that means that you're not a good citizen. What kind of responses have you received after publishing it from both sides of the spectrum?
Oh, man. The weird thing is that article came out, and I had a 7-day-old child, my second child. She was 7 days old, and we had police cruisers in our yard because of all the threats that we had received. So it was quite a whirlwind. And like I received thousands and thousands of emails, and I sat there for hours, and I returned every one of them. And because I felt like this is what professors were supposed to do, we're supposed to teach. And so I use this as the teaching moment. Like many people didn't want to be taught. Many people just wanted to scream at me for doing this. Okay, on both sides. The police, some of the police people who were pro-police emailed me and said, what do you mean use of force? Don't you mean response to resistance? Or, you know, you don't understand. We people are out there to hurt us too. And that's why we use these lower level uses of force. On the other hand, people were upset that we didn't find racial bias in the shootings. And there's nothing I can do. I mean, the data are what the data are. And, you know, we talked earlier about what UTA gave me to get to Harvard. And it's not about getting to Harvard. It was not the destination. It really was the journey and the confidence this institution instilled in me to write papers like this, to say, I will seek truth over popularity. And, you know, it's a work in progress. Not that paper, but we need more of those. We need more analysis of police. We need more data on police. This is a big, important public institution that is a bit opaque for researchers to even, you know, access, right? So this is the start of trying to understand a half-century-old problem or a century-old problem of race and police in America. This is not the end. This is the beginning. This is not the ceiling. This is the floor. And so the point is we need to use this type of analysis to seek truth.
Roland Fryer, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
The preceding program is a production of UTARadio.com and the Department of Communication. Thank you for listening.